Well, I want to invite you to have before you this prophecy from Isaiah. This is the third vision we get from the prophet. We're going through the lectionary readings, the gospel according to Isaiah, prophecies given centuries before the time of Christ, and we've looked at some good ones over the last 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, you may remember, you may not, we spoke of Isaiah's prophecy of the holy mountain raising to the highest place. And all the nations stream to it, and God arbitrates justice, and peace is established. The swords are turned into plowshares, the spears are turned into pruning hooks. A deep vision of peace. And then last week we looked at the king who's coming, and we saw that he is full of God's Spirit. He brings justice and the peaceable kingdom, which transcends even justice as we know it, because the world is transformed. The lion lies down with the lamb. A little child shall lead them. The earth is full of the glory of the Lord. Those are the two prophecies we've looked at so far. Now we have a different spin because we're seeing the joy of the people that are participating in God's kingdom. And I hope you noted, this prophecy is overflowing with joy. From beginning to end, there is gladness, there's singing, there's dancing, there's healing. All the dry places become watery places, and that was important in an ancient culture. There's the desert that blossoms into streams and pools. You find hopeless and fearful and broken people all of a sudden becoming strong and courageous and healed. All of this happens because of verse 4. The promise of this, say to those, verse 4, who are a fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Why? Behold, the King James says, here is your God. This God is coming to save you. Now, like every vision that the prophet Isaiah brings, it's not a naive vision. He's talking to people who know brokenness. They know fear. There's a superpower to the north that is threatening them. They know injustice and corruption. Isaiah is well aware that the world that they inhabit is metaphorically a desert. It is a dry place. It's a wilderness. And yet, in the midst of this wilderness, Isaiah wants to say, verse 1, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. Because the desert will rejoice and blossom, it will blossom abundantly. Wilderness always has to do spiritually with the idea of barrenness, the idea of lifelessness, the idea of being in a place where you have no resources, where you are threatened by all sides. And so there's no comfort, there's no security. And Isaiah knows that his readers, his hearers, are experiencing a desert experience. They know the barrenness and lifelessness that comes by being surrounded by corruption and having threats to the north. They know what it is to be sapped in their spirit and to feel lifeless and barren. And yet, he still promises that the parched lands, the deserts, the wilderness, they will be abundant, like a well-watered garden paradise. They'll burst forth with joy, and not only will the environment be changed, but the people will experience a newfound healing. He speaks of people who are weak and feeble and fearful and broken, all the human frailties that we're aware of, and he says that there will be a newfound strength, a newfound hope, and all the broken will be made whole. So that by the end of this vision, we move from a desert to well-watered places, and everyone's singing for joy. Why? Because God has come. And God has come not only to bring this abundance in the environment, and not only to bring healing, but if you turn your page, God has come to make a way. Because God hasn't arrived yet. The promise is that the Lord will come, but the Lord has not come yet. As Isaiah says, this is still just a hopeful promise in the future. But he does say that there's a way being made even now. And he calls it the Holy Highway. Verse 8, a highway shall be there. It shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it. It shall be for God's people. And my favorite line in this whole reading, no traveler, not even fools, shall go astray, which means there's hope for us all. Then he speaks of no threats, no lion shall be there, no ravenous beast, but the redeemed will walk this way, and this holy highway is a path through the desert and the wilderness that leads into the presence of God. It's a path that every step on it leads in a hopeful, peaceful, joyous direction. So that at the end of our reading, the last three lines, everlasting joys upon their heads. The travelers on the holy highway, they're rejoicing because they know they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. They rejoice because they know that every step, surrounded by the desert, surrounded by the barrenness, with all their brokenness and feebleness, is leading them one step closer to the eternal joy of the God who comes to redeem them. That's why they rejoice. They're not fully in possession of that joy, but they know that joy awaits them. This reminds me of contemporary songs, particularly African-American spirituals, African-Americans who experience such injustice, such deep travesties, and yet you find in the ancient spirituals things and expressions of hope and joy in the midst of deep, deep, bitter hardship. Andre Crouch in 1974 wrote a song that kind of embodies the spirit of African-American spirituals. And you know this song. Soon and very soon, we are going to see the King. No more crying there, no more dying there, no more sighing there. Hallelujah, we're going to see the King. Does that recognize? Anyone recognize that? That's kind of the spirit of the whole idea that soon and very soon, we're not there yet. We don't have this fullness of joy yet. We don't have this complete well-watered oasis yet. But this is what's coming. And so there was a sense of joy even on the pathway to that, as difficult as that pathway was at the moment. Now, if you want to get a little bit closer to home, we have our blues songs and we have our country songs, which also are about hardworking people down on their luck. You know the old joke, what do you get when you play a country song backwards? Well, you get your truck back, your dog back, your wife back, and your job back. That's what happens when you play a country song backwards, which is really what Isaiah 35 is. It's a country song played backwards. Everything that was lost is recovered. Everything is restored so that the only expression left is absolute, utter joy. I love the last three lines. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So it's not just everlasting joy. It's not just that sorrow is eliminated, but even sighing. And you know what sighing is? Sighing is that inexpressible that we have in life, where we're weary, or we regret, or we're longing for union and love, or we're longing for something we don't even know how to name, so we just sigh, all of those sighs being essentially at their heart, a longing for home, a longing for God, a longing to know peace and joy, a longing to be settled and no longer restless and fearful. This is the joy that the prophet promises that's accompanying the people on the holy highway, and that is their end goal, this everlasting joy. He knows their environment's bleak, he knows the landscape is dry, and yet he says God is going to make a way where there was no way, and it's that promise that invites the people of God to begin to experience joy now. And of course, that's what I'd like to reflect upon as we consider the significance of this passage, not only for Isaiah's people in their day, but for us. Because we all know there are a lot of obstacles to joy. There is our environment. There is the barrenness of it. There's the injustice. There's the corruption. There's all the challenges that we all face as we walk through this dark world. And then it's not just challenges without. We all face the challenges within of weakness of body, of frailty, of feebleness, of fearfulness. All of these obstacles to joy. And yet the promise in verse 4 is, in spite of all these obstacles, God is coming. And then in verse 8, God is making a way, a holy highway, a path, because God specializes in doing what no one else can, in making a way where there is no way, in removing the obstacles so that that which our heart desires most deeply might finally be possessed. In the end, you find, according to this prophecy, there will be no obstacle to stand in the way of God's promised Redeemer. Nothing in the environment, nothing within, not even fools. They can't lose their way. There's nothing that's going to be an obstacle. And that's why when the gospel finally arrives, when this begins to be fulfilled in the birth of Christ, the angels will pronounce the gospel first when they say to the shepherds, "Behold, we bring you good news of," you know it, "great joy." It's the reason when we celebrate the birth of the Christ, we sing, "Joy to the world, the Lord has come." We're declaring the gospel, which is to say the gospel is no less, it's more, but it's no less than an invitation to joy. Not just an invitation to know that we shall possess joy, but an invitation to be joyous in the wilderness, in our brokenness, in our feebleness now, even in our foolishness, because even the fool can't lose their way on the holy highway. Now, when you think about joy, what you have to do to really wrestle with it and engage with it is distinguish it from other things, which are its counterfeits. Joy is not happiness. Joy is not pleasure. Joy is something deeper than all those. Happiness is usually based on circumstance. You have a good circumstance, I'm happy. You have bad circumstances, I'm no longer happy. Because the circumstances define whether I'm happy or not. I wish happiness to you all, but the reality is there are circumstances, situations, both without and within, which will take away your happiness if you're just seeking happiness. Pleasure, of course, is often used as a substitute for joy, but pleasure is always fleeting. You pop a chocolate in your mouth, you feel, oh, insane pleasure, particularly if you like it. I'd rather have a blow pop, but either way, you pop something sweet in, you get that sugar rush, you experience pleasure, you have that liaison with a lover. You do something that perhaps is a bit forbidden, but it excites you. I mean, you talk about all kinds of moments of pleasure. But we all know they're fleeting. Because as soon as the sugar rush is gone, as soon as the thrill of the blow pop or the chocolate is over, the pleasure just goes away. Which is why we can never equate joy with pleasure or with happiness. Joy is so much deeper. It's profound. It's a serenity, an inner peace. It is always connected to a deep sense of purpose and meaning. Knowing that we are connected to that which we were made for, which is why all the fleeting pleasures always end up not really serving us fully. Because we were made for the joy of God. Augustine put it this way, "Lord, you've made us for yourself and our hearts are restless until we find rest in you." If you're honest with yourself, you know that restlessness. You know that desert wandering. You know that attempt to fulfill that restlessness with moments of happiness and pleasure. But you also know that they all tend to fall short. You're looking for something deeper. Something that lasts. Something that fits with who you are and why you were made. And once you begin to go down that road with joy, you realize that that's the gospel. The invitation is not just to moments of happiness or fleeting moments of pleasure. It is a call to know that you have been met at the deepest place. The God who's made you to love and to be loved by, to be known by, and to know, that God has come to us and is making a way so that no obstacle can prevent the eternal joy that God has created all of us to share with God. Now that's consistent with Jesus' teaching. It's interesting to me, once you start to go down the road of joy, you realize Jesus, the final night of his life, John 15, he knows he's going to the cross, his disciples are troubled, and he says to them, and I read this at every funeral, but it's for more than funerals, he says to his frustrated disciples, "I've said these things that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made complete." John, the apostle, decades later, writes to a fledgling church community, "I'm writing these things for your joy, that you might know the fullness of joy." Paul in 2 Corinthians says to the Corinthian church, "We, ministers, we're workers for your joy." The whole purpose of ministry is to help you be joyous. It's a service to joy so that God's joy might break into your life and that it might break out through your life to others. Which is why one of my favorite quotes of C.S. Lewis is 7 words long, but it's so good. "Joy is the serious business of heaven." Joy, serious business. Don't you dare write it off as something flippant. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, If God's people don't have love, we're nothing. If we don't have joy, we have no reason to love. Because we were made for eternal joy. Not fleeting pleasure that's easily achieved and easily removed. Not happiness that, again, is something that comes with circumstances. Change your circumstances, and if your happiness is based on that alone, it's over. But joy. Knowing a deep sense that all that you were made to be is found and met in a God who comes to us by grace to redeem and restore in the midst of our deserts and in our wilderness and call us to God's self so that every obstacle, everything that could hurt or hinder is removed and a holy highway is made so that we might know eternal joy. Now I say all that, and yet I have to say, accompanying all that, that you and I know that that joy seems elusive. It's something that comes and goes, just like pleasure, just like happiness. We have moments, and some of us are better than others. Maybe due to personality or other things, we have extended moments of joy. But if we're serious, we all easily lose it. It seems to be passing and not eternal. And yet, we see in a mirror dimly. We are only able to see so much, and one of the reasons that the prophet writes this is he wants us to see, no matter where you're at in this world, in the brokenness, in the wilderness, in the dry, barren wasteland, if you're broken or fearful or wounded in your heart, that the place where God's taking you is a place where they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Now, with all that said, Isaiah has an admonition. So far, we've looked at three visions. Isaiah hasn't called us to do one single thing except for, in our first vision, walk in the light. You might remember that. And that's just a simple admonition. Here you have a stronger admonition. If you look at verse 3, Isaiah gives this vision, but he wants it to connect to our life right now, where he says, if you have this vision, verse 3, strengthen the weak hands. He knows we're weak. Make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Isaiah calls us to action, and he essentially says, hey, fearful, wounded, weak, broken, feeble people, trust. Trust God, be strong, hold your head high, be fearless. What I'm offering you is not just pie-in-the-sky fantasies. I'm telling you where the world is going and where God's bringing it. And if that's true, you of all people who hear it first and participate in it should be full of joy. You should no longer be fearful. You should no longer be feeble. You should no longer be sitting in the corner saying it's all over. Even if the world around you is barren and wilderness, even if your heart is fearful, there is the call to say, this is so true, this is such a reality. Get up. Trust. Move forward in faith. Don't be fearful any longer. And of course, once we're done with this, our reflection on this, what you realize is this is what we've just done. Let's make sure it's not just an empty gesture. We lit a candle. It's the unique candle. It's the only one that's pink up here. We said as the people of God, in the midst of the darkness, we're lighting a candle. Sure, it's dark, it's barren, it's wilderness. Sure, we might be fearful and feeble. But we're lighting a candle and we're saying, joy wins. We're saying that with the other candles, hope, peace, joy, and then next week, love. So that no matter how dark and dry our world is, no matter how much sorrows and sighing abounds, we say in the midst of darkness, behold your God. Emmanuel shall come. And Emmanuel will make a way for the weak and the blind and the fearful and the feeble and the broken. And yes, even fools. There's hope for us all. Because all that group, weak, blind, feeble, fearful, fools, that's God's people, people. That's us. And we're told the way will be making, so don't give in to hopelessness or sorrow. Journey in hope, because our hope leads through the wilderness into the promised land to everlasting joy. I want you to look at the back of your handout, and I just want to read the last three lines to end this. This is the promise before us that calls us to fearless courage. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shuffly away.